I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's May 2002 and Roy Keane has left the Irish World Cup squad. In the team's Japanese hotel, Niall Quinn has been spending exhausting hours attempting to resolve the situation and get Roy back. It's supposed to be a glorious career swan song for Quinn. Instead, as he wrote in his autobiography, things are out of control. Football, which has always been a boyish pleasure, is suddenly a hard adult world. I've never taken it too seriously, but now, right at the end, this has got to me. Quite a time, Niall. But before we get to that, let's talk about Roy. Who's a major character in your career for a number of reasons. There's the perception that would grow that he was the, you know, you were like yin and yang, opposites, opposite personalities. Tell me where you first came across him, and was it always obvious that he was a bit different?
Well, his energy was the first thing that struck me, how he could get up and down the pitch, how he could be so involved in a game, every bit of it, and at a young age, that referees were afraid of their lives of him. And that takes some doing, you know. He had a presence, in other words, right from the get-go, and he became very demanding of those around him, you know, at a very young age. It was just in him. And it was uncomfortable for one or two. You know, you could say, who does this fella think he is? But then it started to play out. He started to bring himself into a level that none of us had been at. And I think therein, you know, is part of the problem that led maybe to this, and that he was just so far ahead of the rest of us in his thinking about why we should be going, where we should be going, what we should be doing.
But he was a young player coming through, and so he's playing at Forest at the start, and you're playing in the First Division as well, and then he's coming into the Ireland squad. Like, was he always that the intense, driven, ruthless player off the field or in the training environment, or did he join in the crack and the banter with the lads as well?
I didn't really know him before the move to Manchester United. He came to Manchester, obviously, and I can remember Kevin Moran and I saying, come on, we'll go down and see Roy. But it wasn't like going to see one of the other Irish players that might have moved to Manchester. You know, this fellow was different. And I remember coming away, Kevin and I had met him, and I was going, well, this guy is serious, you know. And he wasn't one then to say, like, you know, we'll ask him out to... The Irish club used to go to the Ardrí in Moss Side and places like that, all the different Irish bars. And Roy's driven and doing his thing. And you could see there was a wall around him already, you know, that and he was in there hell-bent and determined on getting to the top. You know, I can remember playing one game for Man City when he was literally running every part of the United team, you know, barking orders at everybody. The moment I thought when I went, wow, this fella, you know, he really has got it, was not some outrageous skill, not a great tackle, whatever, not a great pass. A ball came across from a free kick, a corner kick actually it was, and we had a fullback called Franchek. He was a German guy who came, Martin Franchek. And he went up with Cantona for a header. It was played too far to the back post. And he went up with Cantona for a header, and Cantona kind of half-felled him. And the referee blew his whistle. And I was standing there and was there for it. And he roared at the referee, that's a terrible decision. How dare you give a decision like that? And the referee said to him, Roy, I haven't. It's a penalty for you. And I went, what's happening? And Roy just went, yeah, bloody right it is. And he walked off and they got a penalty and they scored. And I looked at it and went, oh, my God, that referee is scared stiff of Roy Keane. And from that moment, I knew this guy.
This is his presence.
The demanding nature of everything. He needed everything to be done. You know, it wasn't just his teammates he wanted well. He wanted every single bit that could work for him. He wanted working the right way. And we were on the negative side of that day, you know. I mean, United got their penalty. And I think about that when people try and say, OK, what did he bring to a team? Because people try and say, well, how many great passes did he make? Or how many great goals did he score? I only have to remember that to know that that's not kicking a ball. That's not you know, lining yourself up in a tactical way. That's not even, you know, your training, your fitness, your determination. That's just presence.
You've said in the past that when you start getting to know him within the Irish squad, like, he's obviously different, but that you, there's something you like about him. There's the famous incident early in his time when he has a go at Mick on the bus. I think it's in America. Mick is the captain, Jack's captain at that time, and a very highly respected Jack's enforcer, essentially. But that it told a lot about Roy.
Yeah, that particular time, we were all at the end of the season and we hadn't played great in the trip out there. Jack was kind of down about how we played. It was, I suppose it would have been, it might have been 92, maybe something like that. It was around the time Roy got in the team. I'm trying to think when Roy first got in the side. And we went out to play in a tournament. We didn't quit ourselves very well. And we went on the beer for a day and a half afterwards. And some of us were late getting back to the bus, and Jack had already gone to the airport and left Mick in charge. And Mick, as we got on the bus one by one at the head office, you know, even though he was a player, you know, how dare you? You're a disgrace. You should know better, Niall Quinn. You know, who do you think you are coming this late? You know, Ronnie Whelan, who do you think you are? You know, and then it came to Roy, and Mick just went, first trip, disgrace. And Roy just went, first touch, disgrace. And the whole bus went, oh my God, that's the most incredible comeback I've ever heard. And you were kind of rooting for him in one way. You know, we're all great friends of Mick, but it was, wow, this bloke's afraid of nothing, you know, because Mick would have been tougher to deal with than Jack. Because Mick was, you know, that stubbornness, that toughness was coming at you, and it's all laid out in front of you, and he's criticised. And we were late. We were bang out of order. Mick Byrne had packed for us. We'd forgotten to pack. Mm-hmm. And Mick Byrne went into every room and threw things in bags and brought them. None of us even knew if we had all our clothes. But we were, you know, taken aback, I think, by that. We all got on the bus, sobered up immediately, and went, wow, that was incredible. Did you hear that? Like, you know, you could see everyone going, oh, God, I can't believe he said that. You know, and so you knew then he wasn't here for the ride. He was here to make a huge impression. And I have to say, you know, people say, oh, he had to go with you, have a go back. It's very hard to do that when you know that there were games that we played in. Unfair on the other players to say that he won them single-handedly for us, but we wouldn't have won them without him.
He comes in as a young player. He becomes the dominant player in the Irish team. The perception, I don't know if it's what he holds himself, is that he's trying to do things the right way and that you guys are the sort of... The rest of the squad are sort of like a jolly boys outing kind of thing, which, you know, not expecting the same standards, not demanding, which I'm sure... Mm-hmm. That must rankle because you were all professionals in your own right, and that was a kind of a characterization that would come out in the media in the aftermath of Saipan eventually. So the perceptions that he would have had or that people on the outside would have had, like how fair or unfair were them in the years leading up to Saipan?
So the narrative got there after the event, but none of us felt we were rag-arse rovers and weren't bothered about how it went. We found it difficult that he would be so... alarmingly aghast at what was going on out there, given that for all our international matches for the last couple of years, he was only coming in sometimes on the Tuesday. Mm. And we were all in on the Saturday. So we had this specialist status, this privileged status in the team for a couple of years. So it was difficult, I think, for him to say things aren't done right when he wasn't there all the time. But he got special privilege. And some funny things come out of it. I remember doing a thing, Ruby Walsh on TV saying, oh, Roy King got you on the first-class seats. No, he didn't. It was done long before he came to the team. You know, so the people who did that, and I was involved in it, you know, I remember saying, come on, guys, you have to give us the leg room for long flights. We had that conversation, but the myth has it that Roy...
That's the way the story came
out. And so this is what happens when the narrative goes...
You describe it in your book, which was written shortly after the time, that, you know, you said, Roy will have me down as too soft, too nice, too much of a goody-goody... Too damn happy with my lot. Football's version of the singing nun. Like, this is a perception. This is
I had to sell a book at the time, Tommy. My career was over.
But, you know, this is a perception. And this is, you know, the sort of the Mother Teresa stuff that came out. And, you know, you talked about how he could be hurt, how he could cut to the quick with his tongue, which came out in Saipan. He did it with Mick on the bus with the first touch. You get the brunt of that as well. So are you sort of as understanding... at the time of...
Do you know what? Gillian laughed. And when she laughed, that kind of killed it already. Because I go, what's he have to say? Like, and she laughed her head off. And I went, you know what? It was a good one. It was a good one. You know, I'll give him that. It was a good one.
Just to set the scene for 2002 for you and for the country, if you like, you know, you'd had the personal frustration of missing 94 with the injury. The team had agonisingly missed Euro 2000 qualification. It was a big moment for Mick. for the, all the squad, for Roy, who'd driven the team there, and for the whole country at the time, wasn't it? So that was the sort of the...
It was huge,
know, and
yeah.
for you, the swan song of your career yeah. coming into this, all these emotions boiling up in one little island in the Pacific.
Yeah, it was all meant to be a perfect send-off for me. I was granted a testimonial, which I had, which the players met up for the trip to play in. Roy didn't, but everybody else did. And that was great. That was the end of my career and nice way to do it. Then go off and do my international stuff and I'll see how far we can go. If I'm needed, I'm needed. If I don't play, it's not, you know, it's because we're doing well. It means Robbie and Damien are going good. David Connolly, these people, Clinton Morrison. But I'm there as an old cheerleader to make sure things are okay. And obviously that fell apart then, you know, a week, 10 days later, but it did. And wish I was equipped to deal with it better. Mm. And looking back, there's not lots of things I would have done differently, and I'm sure everybody would have in every part of it. But, you know, I think the bit that I like to think about most, because it doesn't bother me, it doesn't interest me, say, you know, having cuts of people, digging back, whatever, trying to work it out, is how well people stepped up to the plate at a difficult circumstance and a difficult time, you know. I'm talking about the Mark Kinsels of this world, the Gary Breens of this world. You know, Kenny Cunningham's, that said, right, okay, we're under the cosh here. You know, we have a manager who's been put through the mill and we have a situation back home and here because, you know, it was so big. Mm. And we can't do anything about it while we're here other than play well. And everybody bought into it. And I think the best thing I can say about that group of players, and I was a part player, I come on a sub a bit, was that they were determined at that point that their football would be remembered in the midst of the biggest story probably in football since maybe Maradona's handball against England. And that they achieved that, I think, was remarkable. That Robbie had the tournament he had, that Duffer had the tournament he had, you know, that the players played, Gary Breen and the you know, the performances that took place, you know, and Steve Staunton, who led them at times as well as a leader. It was pretty remarkable, I think, when I look back to say, with everything that was going on, how players who probably weren't as fashionable as Roy, you know, in terms of, you know, what the world of football thought about Ireland, but yet they were able to wear the green jersey in the most difficult of circumstances, A, with such pride, but B, to play so well in it, and to at least show that we had a half-decent football team. And then the other bit is the aftermath. How, with a team emerging of with Damien and Robbie and Richard Dunne coming into the fold and John O'Shea coming into the fold, that all these players were about to, you know, to really become proper international players, given where we were, and that how Spain, who we brought to within a whisker of beating, went on to win the Euros and the World Cup, and yet we fell apart. But what I witnessed in my career, when we had Roy Keane at full fettle, they were days when we could play anyone and take anybody on. Mick was also an issue. And I don't think people realise this, but as the swell went to get Roy back, Mick then said, hang on a minute, I'm the manager. Mm. And that was the bit, really, that I wasn't ready for.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think it's reached the end now. The players, especially the younger players, can't take anymore. It had to come to this. I'm just so devastated because we came so very close.
The legacy of Saipan, you've sort of spread out, and maybe it's like the French Revolution. You know, you'll still be saying it's too early to tell what the impact of it was. You have this press conference where you come out and you have to speak, and it's that line about in your book about it's the end of the boyish pleasure of football. This is a whole different horrible world. Is that ultimately because you just couldn't put it back together? You just couldn't fix the situation
possibly,
as much as you wanted to.
But I also, and anytime I thought like that, I also thought, Jesus, I wonder how Roy is feeling. You know, he must be in a dreadful place altogether. So I was feeling bad, but he was the real sufferer. And I didn't speak to him that time, but I was speaking hourly to Michael Kennedy. And Michael was also, you know, making effort to see how we could do this.
Who represented both of us at
a particular time, yeah. So it was bleak as I look back. I try not to look back on things that I'm uncomfortable with. I try and put them out of my mind. I forget names. People think I'm lying and stuff. I don't. I'm good at blocking out bad stuff and I concentrate on good stuff. But what I would say about that particular time and you know, in dealing with Michael and wondering where it was is, you know, that Mick was also an issue. And I don't think people realise this, but as the swell went to get Roy back, Mick then said, hang on a minute, I'm the manager. Mm. And that was the bit, really, that I wasn't ready for. I thought Mick would be delighted to see him back, that we get the whole thing settled. And because of the way things were to-ing and fro-ing, and Mick and his age and his people were doing different things, I was where I was. I hadn't allowed for the fact that, do you know what, Mick might want him back. And there was that story that was, you know, can we get him back? Does Mick want him back? And we as players then thought, you know, everything Roy had done for us, you know, and as players, you know, we've got to try and do this and make sure that he knows that we're on his side and we want to come back. And Mick got wind of that and he wasn't very happy with that. So now we're in a position where, you know, Mick could be deciding to go home. He'd say, well, if you can have him, do you know Mick a bit stubborn. I think, oh my God, what have we gotten ourselves into here? And so as I remember then we had to, you know, Mick called a meeting and demanded that we said, did we want him as a manager or what? Where were we going? In other words, it was that I was getting too busy with trying to bring the whole thing back. So as we agreed then that before training, we would back Mick if we know, because we were hoping we'd find out for definite whether Roy's come back. But we would be able to say after Roy had decided that, you know, look, we're right behind Mick and sorry that Roy's not here. But someone in the FAI gave that to the press before the training session finished. And that was a killer blow. And we were shocked when we heard that. But that tells you some of the stuff that was...
Because it looked like...
We were saying, we would make Roy, you stay where. But there was another play to go before that should ever have got to light. That was only an event at the end. That was only a statement that was to be made at the end when we know that it's definitely all over. But what happened was it was used to make it all over. And that's a big regret that I have. But it affected Roy far more than anybody. It probably affected Mick too and everything that he's gone through. And as he says himself, people ask him about it all the time and he gets annoyed with it, etc. It's had an enduring legacy of what if, you know, had he been fit, strong, playing and leading us, you know, could we have gone further than we did?
What if?
What if? My what if is more because my last game was against Spain. I didn't take a penalty. And I played, I think, 92 games for my country. I think all in all, I had about 650 games in football and I should have taken one more kick, one more penalty. But such was the exuberance of the youngsters by this stage, they'd gone from being demoralised on the way back from Saipan to now believing we could nearly win this and they'd be heroes. And there was an expression to take penalties, about eight or nine, and I'll take one. So when it all settled down, I said, Mick, I'll take the sixth one. I took one in Wembley, the sixth one, when it got really nervy. And
playoffs.
And I'll do that. And Mick went, that'll do for me. And so the others went in. And then afterwards, I went, one more kick. That's all I needed. And my what if now, or how I, and this happens once a month in my life, I wake up in the middle of the night. It's the same every time. My penalty gets us through. And I jump up to the railings afterwards and the play's over. And then we beat Korea easily because they play the long ball to me. I keep my place against South Korea. We're in the semi-final, we're against Germany again, they're afraid of their lives and me, and we're about to get into the final to play Brazil, and then I wake up and we're here where we are. That happens regularly. It still does.
Are you serious? That still happens?
100%.
My God. that's incredible.
I don't think about any other game I ever played.
Later, you know, you'd get to know Roy a bit better. Well, you certainly work with him, and he would hint in his later sort of reflections on it in his second book, maybe, that he kind of felt in retrospect he was too much enthralled to Alex Ferguson and his priorities with United at the time. And there was just a hint of regret from him that he didn't sort of realise at the time that what the other game was going on with the club versus country thing. Do you think, reading between the lines with him, that's how he feels now?
I'm not quite sure that I'm able to say it for him, but what I could say for myself is when Howard Wilkinson came to Sunderland and turfed me out, I felt like it was the greatest injustice in the history of football. And so you develop a sense of anger at that time. I mean, I felt I'd given my heart and soul to Sunderland. I had 9 months left on my contract. Peter Reid had made me assistant manager. So I felt, this is my world, I'm going to be a coach now. And Howard Wilkinson came in and went, right, we're not having you. Let it die down for a few weeks and we'll give you a free transfer. You can go wherever you want. And it really, that's all I've done here. And the build-up to that was I was preparing the team until the new manager came. So I was the caretaker, even though there wasn't a match. And the chairman every day had been ringing me about who was going to be Mickey Adams, it was going to be Mick McCarthy. And he was ringing me every night, which one do you think? Oh, I'm going to go Mickey Adams. Oh, no, tell me about Mick McCarthy. And I didn't want to be seen to be swaying it one way, but I spent an hour on the Wednesday night, I think it was, or the Tuesday night, speaking to the chairman and put the phone down. And the next morning, I come in early to pick the team. And the kit man says, Howard Wilkinson is the new boss. And I remember saying to him, that's why you're a kit man and I'm taking the first team. Right? And I went out and we trained, and halfway through training, the club secretary stopped training, called me over and went, Howard Wilkinson has just been made the new manager. And I went, wow, chairman has done me a kipper there. Mm-hmm. He spent an hour on me last night between Mick and Mickey Adams. And I had to wait around. He said he'd come and see me. He eventually saw me at 5 o'clock. He walked in and threw the tennis nets down, got the groundsman to take the head tennis nets away, which I'd put up for all the kids, had done since I got there. So all our kids would play the first team, intermix first team players with kids, with the under-18s, etc. And he walked in the gates and went, get these down now. So I knew I wasn't in a great place. And the rage I had, because he did that to me, and at 5 o'clock he told me I was no longer part. So Roy might have had a bit of that, I think, after all, because he had done big, big things for Sir Alex, for Manchester United. And Fergie hasn't always been brilliant to those who have done the work for him. So that's a natural reaction, and I can see it and I feel for him, and I know what he went through. His much bigger than mine, but that is a player's reaction. When you think you've done something, you've led something further than it could ever have done without you, which is what, you know, in your own big head, that's what you think you did at Sunderland. In my case, Fergie just, phew, no time now for Roy Keane, move on, and that hurt. And maybe at that point, you know, at this point, well, you know, it affected so many other things, including the World Cup in 2002, so maybe that's where he's coming from, but it would make sense. I went up to the boardroom, knocked on the door to speak to the chairman. The vice chairman came out and said, he doesn't want to speak to you, Niall. He knows you're in foul humour. And I just went, okay, well, I'm going home, but tell him I'll be back one day. And he went, oh, yeah, that'd be great, Niall. We'd love to have you back as manager here, maybe. And I went, no, I'll be coming back to run the club.
October 19th, 2002, Sunderland lose 1-0 at home to West Ham, and that would be the last time that you'd play the game, which had made you a star, given you a good living, and so many happy memories over the decades that you'd had. Upon finishing, now just going back to what you'd written in your book at the time, you said 20 years in the game and you were as happy as when you started out. That was the secret, being happy. At the time, did you realise how much of your identity and that happiness was wound up in being a footballer? And when that was taken away from you, and when you retired, how much of that happiness left you?
Well, I'd done zero preparation for a career transition. So first and foremost, after the row with Howard Wilkinson, there was a gap of about 10 days before the first game. I stayed away, and eventually he called me in on the Friday before the first game, and he said, I'm playing you tomorrow. And I felt he was trying to make a fool of me. And I went, you're just trying to make me look bad in front of the fans because you're getting a lot of stick because they know I'm not training, they know I'm not involved. And he went, no. I went, it's okay, if you're serious, I'll go on the bench and if you need me, I'll go on. And I went on with 20 minutes to go and I played really well. I should have scored an equaliser. Kevin Kyle actually fouled me as I was about to score. He was one of our own players. And afterwards he pulled me and he said, I might have got it wrong about you. You and I need to sit down and chat. And me being thinking I know everything went, no, you had your chance, I'm gone. And I went up to the boardroom, knocked on the door to speak to the chairman. The vice chairman came out and said, he doesn't want to speak to you, Niall. He knows you're in foul humour. And I just went, okay, well, I'm going home, but tell him I'll be back one day. And he went, oh, yeah, that'd be great, Niall. We'd love to have you back as a manager here, maybe. And I went, no, I'll be coming back to run the club. And he laughed, and I went, okay, we'll see. And 3 years later, I did it. So in that period of 3 years, my head went in all sorts of directions. Mm. And I wasn't ready for any transition. I had a lovely few weeks when I came back home. It took us a few months to come home after that. But I came home the following spring, April time, actually. The Special Olympics were on. There was a heat wave in the country. Everyone I knew was playing golf. I thought, wow, this country's unbelievable. This is nothing like England. And for 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks maybe, I thought, wow, this is great. And then it hit. You know, the routine is gone. The pat on the back is gone. The lights are gone out. You're not in the papers anymore. Million one things I could point to that I just didn't understand. And I became very introverted for a long time, and even stopped playing golf with people and would go to the driving range on my own. No, I wasn't bad now. And players had it a lot worse than me. A lot of players had it worse than me. And, you know, I can remember getting asked by Jeff Shreves, who I knew well from the football world, come and do a bit of Sky for us. And I wouldn't do it. And James was going, you have to do something, you know. So I remember just so set against it. Football, I was anti-football at that time.
Why was that?
I felt the game had spat me out.
Yeah.
You know, and
you're bitter.
Yeah, and I'd allowed it to, and I didn't see it coming. And I started to find, you know, in my social life, I was into Nace near where we lived. There was a couple of pubs there that I would go most nights, or there was a pub up in Ballymore. And I just found myself in this feeling sorry for myself routine for months and months and months.
And you were drinking a lot at the time,
yeah,
right?
I was drinking far more than I would have, you know. I'm well able to drink. I was always able to drink, but this was no time to start getting better at it, you know. Yeah. And so I had a funny time of it. And Jeff asked me to go over. And I remember one time they booked the flights. They did everything. And I got out to Dublin Airport and I turned back. And I told Gillian I couldn't do it. And I told Jeff that the flight was cancelled. But I should have known. They'd have known the flight wasn't cancelled. But they persevered with me anyway, and eventually I got over, and I can remember almost hiding, going in, trying to get into the studio, which was a suite in the club itself, trying to get there in a way that I wouldn't catch anyone's eye who wouldn't see me. I felt an outcast. I just didn't feel I belonged to football. And of course, those who take the brunt of it most are your family, you know. Yeah. The last thing that my family needed was me to turn into this wreck feeling sorry for himself, you know. And in fairness, Gillian recognised it, and you know, she obviously had a circle of friends, and they were all going through the same issues, same problems. And our marriage stood the test of it, thankfully. But lots of our friends didn't, and it was all between that age you quit 35 to 40. Disastrous amount of relationships had folded. Great friends of ours thought they were far more rock solid than us. And Gillian started to look at it. She went back to college. She did a psychology degree, and she's now doing a doctorate on the sports career transition of footballers and why 3/4 of their marriages are gone within 3 years of or 3 or 5 years of finishing. So it's not a problem for the outside world.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not looking for sympathy here.
But it's something you're passionate about, and you're as a family.
Yeah, and because I just know other players, the lot goes. You know, marriage goes, income goes. Reason for living goes, and a bitterness creeps in with people, and it leads to us. Look, there's been suicides, there's been lots. You know, it's a bit of a taboo subject, because football clubs don't like to prepare their players for finishing. They want to think they can keep going forever, so you don't have this natural progression into your next career, which perhaps you do in rugby. You know, where they're preparing you for a life in the financial world or the legal world, or you go to college. And football is, hey, get in the bus, go to games, get as much money as you can. Nobody stops you to prepare yourself, and I think it will change, because the fall is so big, the players are so famous now, and they're earning so much money that when it falls apart.
Just following the story since day one, by the way, it's worth mentioning, like you said, you had a lot of lucky breaks with managers and moves and things like that. How big a lucky break was Gillian, by the way? Because when you had the first cruciate, you know, you said she stopped you drinking yourself to death and, you know, settling you down in your wild younger years. But at this time...
Yeah, listen, I speak about other players and I'm like, love to tell you it was all perfect, you know, and she went, but she'll say she was. But, you know, I was a problem, of course I was.
Were you selfish?
Yeah, I would have thought so. Yeah, it comes with the nature of being a professional footballer and your name in lights for a long time. You get ideas about yourself and you do get selfish. And she persevered and she put up with a lot, and, you know, the road was rocky at times. And she was the one who did all the flattening of the curve, of the bumps and the straightening of the curve. So delighted now, we're 30 years together over 30 years, and there's nothing at all I or any of us do without almost running it past her. You know, and that's some stuff that she doesn't even know about. So do you think this is the right thing to do? She's got a wise old head, and you know, she has she's been of enormous value to me, and
to say the least,
yeah. And I think you know, you can, like, we were put together as a footballer model couple, you know, and Ireland was kind of beginning to get Celtic Tigerish in the early 90s when we got married, and you know, we were seen as some kind of celebrity couple, and Gillian made sure that was bullshit for the papers, and that we had a pattern and routine between ourselves and an understanding with our family that there was certain rules. I broke a good few of them. She broke none, you know, but I broke most of them. But she held me to account and eventually straightened me up enough to kind of let me off out my own to the world, which I, you know, I go off and do my stuff now, and whether it's here, you know, which is a fabulous role for me to have. I absolutely fell on my feet coming here at Virgin Media. You know, A, it's near where we are, but B, it just gave me a chance to express myself the way I wanted to that I mightn't have been able to in the past. That's great. I got involved in other sort of types of businesses, and all the while she's been very supportive. Yep, go for it. There's been no, like, do this, you must do this, you must do that, and at the same time keep me right, but giving me a chance to see out and do important things that I want to wake up every day and jump out of bed to do. They drew up a list and Roy wasn't on it. I said, Sean, I'm going to go into this meeting here, I don't want to make a fool of myself, what do you think if I... And he went, brilliant, you've nailed it, that's the one. And make sure you don't make up with him, because it'll keep the story going for the next 5 years if you're fighting all the time.
Let's talk about the other rocky road then, and Roy again. So that was you had an inkling of what the future lay ahead when you said, I'll be back to run this club one day. How did it come about that you fronted a consortium to take over Sunderland? Mm-hmm. And of all people, why Roy?
Well, in the first instance, the same chairman who I wanted to get that message to got in touch with me to say that the club was in big trouble and that the foundation, which had recently been formed in my time as a player, was in danger of going under, and could I come and take over the foundation in name and try and save that from the ensuing problems that the club have. And I went to meet him in London, and we spoke about it, and he broke down, he started crying, and also he said, I have to get someone to buy this club. Now, that was a meeting in a hotel about the foundation part of the club. And quite quickly I went, well, the Celtic Tiger is flying. I know some good people. They may be interested. They may trust me to put something together. He went, be very grateful if you did. And that's how it started. And I'd been in racing syndicates with a few people, and I had some great friends that had done very well for themselves. Most people seemed they were doing very well for themselves in the Celtic Tiger. But there was a kind of an acceptance and a positivity when I went to the first few people. And you know, I'll never forget how, when push came to shove, they supported me, the likes of Charlie Chalk and the likes of Louis Fitzgerald, that when it got serious and there was, you know, sort of meat on the bones, and I'd done some ploughing and we were actually getting into the groove here of appointing lawyers and going where we were going, the way I was backed by these people, Patsy Byrne, who's no longer with us, one of Kerry's greatest exports, you know, there was Pat Byrne, a man in Athlone, who just came in and loved football and wanted things done the right way. It was quite incredible. Paddy Kelly, he's no longer with us. He was a developer from Kildare. He's just a beautiful man. Sean Mulrine, who's, you know, again, doing brilliant things with Ballymore right now. I was backed by a load of brilliant people. Jack Tierney, who's a hotelier. And they gave me the belief that I could do this and that they would support me and they would give me the help in and around what they do. So they would give me their best financial people, their best legal people, etc., and that they would help me learn how to buy a football club and B, how to run it. And we put boards together. So Drumbleville was the group's name, and they put some great people. Bill Barrett was a great man, you know, a wise old businessman who gave me great counsel. There was some brilliant people. Dennis McCoy was another man who...
They obviously trusted you, because when you said, who's going to be the manager, Roy Keane, well, they didn't think you were...
It was interesting. So where it went, we kind of drew up a list and... Well, no, sorry. They drew up a list and Roy wasn't on it. Mm. And I spoke to... Sean O'Ryan actually was... I said, Sean, I'm going to go into this meeting here. I don't want to make a fool of myself. What do you think if I... And he went, brilliant. You've nailed it. That's the one. Mm. And make sure you don't make up with him, because it'll keep the story going for the next 5 years if you're fighting all the time. It's all about marketing. Yeah. And so I thanked him and we went into the meeting, and as soon as I mentioned Roy, a couple of people were shocked.
Yeah.
But a couple of people, yeah, let's try it. And then we had the serious meeting. Now we're getting near the finish line and we have to go over the line. And we went over the line thinking Roy was coming in. And then very near the date of going over the line, it turned out he wasn't. And so I literally said, okay, well, I'll take it for now. We'll back people off. And that was a great decision, because we were still trying to buy the football club. And I can remember my first day there, we had to have 90% of the agreement among the shareholders for the deal to go through. And we had got about 87, 88, which meant we had to ring shareholders, the other 13%. But because it was a PLC, these were people who bought 50 quid's worth and 100 quid's worth. So there was thousands of them. And having done all the press, you know, for the first day or two, three days afterwards, I can remember picking up the Sunderland Evening Echo or the Sunderland Echo, and looking at it, and the front page was a picture of all the chairmen of the club that they ever had. Is this man up to it? And I got a jolt, because I'd never stopped to think about what the people would think and what the city is thinking. And we were in real bad way, and we were trying to get people in, but at this stage we'd managed through Michael Kennedy to get Roy back into Vogue, that he might do it. And
what was the conversation like with Roy? And because you hadn't spoken since...
Well, we'd met in the build-up to when we thought he was coming in and that he might have come straight in, but he decided he wanted to go on holiday and he just quit from football and he needed some time. So that was fine. We met in Sean Mulryan's house, actually, in Wicklow, and we were all there. Drumble guys were there, and Roy came in, and Roy said, "Is it okay if Niall and I have a chat first?" And I went, "Don't go too far, lads." You know. But it was always, "Look, are we going to do this? We're going to do it. Put things behind us. Let's go for it." And yep, that's exactly what I was hoping you'd say, and that's where we did it, where we kind of, that's the way we tried to do it, and I let him.
Marked.
I'd like to think he knows I did it. As chairman, I did it in a way that would help him the most, didn't interfere, and tried as I could to think what was best, knowing what I knew as a player, but also knowing what I had to know in terms of making the books balance, etc. Look, there were times you wanted lots of money for players, and I'm there saying, "Look, Roy, we can't. This is the way. This, you know, you have those conversations, but then you also see him, you know, and I would say at his best.
Why did it work for Roy at Sunderland?
Because Roy not only lifted our dressing room, which had a losing mentality, went down with the lowest points total ever twice in the last 3 years. They got up, Mick had managed to bring them up in the middle of that, but they had broken their own record for being the worst team ever in the Premier League twice. So it was a losing mentality. And those who were there didn't want to be there. When I joined, you know, the first four players I spoke to, I saw them all the first day and I went in. The first four handed me transfer requests. So you imagine what you're inheriting there. Now, also imagine Sunderland, as you know, I've been telling you, and you'll know from the documentaries that I've done it, how important the Sunderland Football Club is to the people up there. And they're negative. So it was a tough place. But there was a bit of belief in the air, because I had come in. But then Roy comes in through the doors. And not only does he lift a dressing room and turn that losing mentality into one that's now suddenly got a conscience about itself and is going to perform, he's turned the city. And the city now begin to believe that they have a big club again. And that was huge. And by his presence, that's all he had to do.
Yeah, he said in his book that you were bringing him round to try and sell season tickets to functions, fan events, which he says, "I would normally hate that kind of thing, but I actually really loved it."
Well, I have to tell you one of the best memories I have. I have two I want to tell you, but the one I want to tell you about that particular night, you know, I gave the banqueting, head of banqueting to a young lad, a great character. He was nowhere near the pecking order, but he just worked so hard and he was a great guy, Gary Hutchinson. And Gary said to me, "I'm having an event for all the wealthy people in the Northeast. It's going to be a great event. I need Roy there." I went, "Oh, geez, here we go." You know, so this is going to be the first test in the first couple of months, you know. So I rang Roy and I said, "Listen, you don't have to do this." And, you know, I'm typical Roy. He went, "What makes you think I wouldn't do it?" And I went, "You're right, actually. Yeah, my fault." And he went, I'll be there. And I went, great. So say we to be there at 7:30 or whatever time, I don't know. Anyway, we're all there, all these luminary businessmen, you know, that in the Northeast and the Northeast Chamber and all, you know, the sheriff of this. You know, we were quite a big gathering to sell boxes. And we were all there anyway and looking at a watch, hoping Roy would come, you know. And Roy breezed in, a room full of hugely successful business people, men and women, politicians, fell silent. Never seen anything like it. The room stopped. And he walked up to where Gary and I was and went, so what have I to do? So anyway, we're just here, just talk to people. So it's like, oh, okay, I'll speak to these. And he went over to this lovely people. So you Sunderland fans, yeah. Then the murmur started again. People started talking again in the background. And I was just listening to him and he went, so are you buying a box or what? Well, yeah, okay, we'll buy it then and stop talking about it. And he moved on to the next one. And he sold 25 boxes. He took 500,000 out of their pockets that night. He walked out the door and they all stood and gave him a big clap. Now, that's not normal.
Yeah.
That's just incredible. So when people say, have a go at Roy Keane, he's had a go at you, I've seen things like that are just incredible. And the second thing I want to tell you about is a football that, you know, we worked very hard at the Christmas, even though we didn't have a lot of money, and fair play to Charlie Chalks and Louis Fitzgeralds of this world, Sean Ryan's, they all ponied up to buy us a chance to have a go at getting up in the summer. And we bought players. We bought three players at Christmas. Anthony Stokes was one of them. But it was great. And we made the effort to do them, and we got them, and they were going playing their first game. And we get to the ground, and all very well. I think we were in Barnsley, if my memory serves me well. And it was a bit of a local derby for us because there was no Newcastle or Middlesbrough. So it was the nearest fans. So we had brought 12,500 fans, and the Barnsley seats had moved to the one end. We took three of the away ground. And they were absolutely convinced that we were going to go up that year. So the fun was brilliant. 12,500 away fans, a whole lot. And I go to Leeds Airport, pick the lads up, Charlie, Louis and a few others, and we get to Barnsley and we're in having a drink, wait for the game to start. And the PR girl comes in, can I have a word? Yeah, he went, Roy has sent three new signings home. I went, what? So, geez, the lads have just put their money in their pocket. This is them to see the fruits of their gift to the club. I went, you're joking. I went, yeah, they were late for the bus. I went, oh, my God. Have we enough for the bench? I went, yeah, he's brought three kids up from the youth team game and we got the bench. I said, so the three signings, the one, you know. So I had to go back into the boardroom and say, lads, you know the players we bought? Yeah, and it's great. Yeah. They ain't playing today. And I went, why not? They went, Roy has sent them home. They were late for the bus. And he went, they were shocked. And I went, brilliant. Just brilliant. And they didn't know whether it was or not, but they were saying, well, we're in now.
Yeah.
It was going to be brilliant. And we went out there, and word went through the stadium what had happened. It was in, you know, build-ups to matches on radios, etc. And the atmosphere that day was incredible. 12,500 out of a 16,000 stadium. And they all knew what had happened, and it was incredible. And the players were just magnificent on the day. Dwight York had the game of his life. And we won convincingly. And it was incredible. And at that stage, then, what happened, I normally would bring the guys back to the airport and drive home. They got a lift from somebody. So I was now driving up to the Northeast on my own. And I was getting into the car out in the back of the car park. And Roy happened to walk past me. And I just kind of went, you know, we didn't have a lot. We never had that many meetings. But I went, well done. And he went, yeah, just boys need a bit of discipline in this club. Yeah, and I went, yeah, fair play. And he just got in his car and drove off, and I just went, wow, the crowd, he had the palm of his hand. They were singing to the song of Hey Jude, you know, they were singing Roy Keane, you know. And they sang it for half an hour after the match. And I remember going up the motorway, and you'd never listen to the BBC or whatever, you know, the phone in, because unless you won 5-0, you wouldn't listen, because you're going to get it somewhere. And I thought, I'm going to listen to it today. And the amount of Sunderland fans that were ringing in and talking and praising him. This is what we need. This is what this club needs. Discipline. We've been trying. The players said, this is the man for us. And I'll never forget that, you know, we were a championship team dominating the airwaves on the call-ins. And that's what he raised. And, you know, within a short space of time, Chelsea
magic.
Interested in signing Roy Keane as manager. Like, that was all within 6 months.
Things would obviously take a turn and you he would leave and you would eventually leave.
Not before he got us into the Premier League.
Into the Premier League, yeah. And you described that time as one of the hardest, most challenging but most exhilarating times of your life. Unfortunately, we're out of time. There's so many football stories of yours that we could tell. Can I just ask you to sum up then mentioned at the start that, you know, you felt you'd enjoyed lucky breaks in your life, that you were always the optimist in any dressing room you were in, that we could turn this around, lads. And like your hero, Jack Doyle, that you mentioned, that you like to walk on the sunny side of the street in life. Is that still the case to end?
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes I get all wound up and get a bit negative, and that happened when I went back into the FAI for a little while, because I was so fed up with the way things had been happening, not with the association itself, but maybe the outward view and people not really pulling the same weight as I was in terms of trying to get the thing better. And so I let that get to me a little bit, but you know, generally I'm out of it a few weeks now, and I'm doing what I want to do. And I've come back to college. I'm doing I'm studying history, which I love, and I'm having a great time at that. I'm making decisions for myself now, not other people. But I guess overall, where I am now, I was the luckiest bugger alive. I mean, the two goals that stood out for me that meant everything to me was my debut goal against Liverpool. Bruce Grobbelaar threw it out to me, fumbled, and I scored. And Hans van Breukelen in a World Cup threw a ball out to me and I scored. But I followed in, because Pat Rice was always happy to follow in. He said, one day you might get one goal that you'll remember forever. Well, I've got two out of it that I remembered forever. And I went through what I thought was a brilliant time, but wasn't really sure until this year, funny enough, I saw what 1990 really meant. Because we weren't here for it all. And we saw the impression it made in the nation. And then obviously Jack's passing, to being around in his time, Howard Kendall, you know, Mick McCarthy, who as a player and manager, Peter Reid, who you know, had such success with, to be lucky to have been with characters. But the greatest luck of all is being part of a strong dressing room, being part of a great dressing room. The Irish one was exceptional by comparison to other international dressing rooms, where you come in for a few days and you head out, but ours was a family, it was different. And I have to say, you know, Sunderland, what we had, the time Phillips was around and where we were, because we were playing beyond our abilities. There's no doubt about that. None of us ever played any good like that again, wherever. Even though I quit, others went. We didn't get somebody to go bigger. We just all maxed out at the same time, because we had a bond in that dressing room to die for. And if you were to say, is there one thing I miss, be that dressing room.
Niall, it's been a great story. Thanks for telling us.
Well, thanks for putting up with me.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.